Blog Talk Radio.
Again, folks, every week we bring you live from our seven satellite studios the EAL radio show. With this, our 77th radio broadcast, your hosts welcome you to tonight's show. Let me introduce your hosts for tonight's show. Neil and Margaret, how are things down in Ponte Vedra, Florida?
Well, Bill, we've had a cloudy day here in the greater Jacksonville, Florida area, along with some scattered thunderstorms. But with the temperature being at a nice 76 degrees, we certainly aren't going to complain. By the way, it might be of interest to our listeners. Did you know that area-wise, Jacksonville is the largest city in the United States?
Population-wise or geographically, Margaret?
Geographically.
Okay. I was going to say, with all the cars that I encountered down in South Florida, I think Miami is pretty large, a very large city. I think it's probably number one in the state. But here on the First Coast, we've had some rain, and right now we're enjoying every drop of it. But if you ever get a chance to come to Jacksonville or St. Augustine, stop by and to the studios here and love to talk with you. Bill?
Going on down the coast to Delray Beach, Florida, we have Jan DeBushkaye. Hi, Jan. Got anything the Chamber of Commerce would want you to say about Delray Beach?
Sure do, Bill. Downtown Delray affectionately is known as Florida's Village by the Sea. It's home to singles, couples, families with children, and young active retirees. Many international families have chosen downtown as a second home when visiting the U.S. With temperatures ranging from the mid-70s for most of the year, downtown Delray's cool ocean breeze and wonderful climate is the perfect place to be. With award-winning beaches and a bustling downtown district, vibrant nightlife, and rich cultural heritage, you can always find a wonderful happening downtown, both day and night. Delray Beach hosts numerous events and programs for both residents and visitors. Regardless of what time of year it is, there is usually something fun going on. In fact, Delray Beach recently was awarded a new title, that is, the most fun small town in America. When pre-planning your vacation, you can click on the monthly and annual event calendar at www.downtowndelraybeach.com.
Thank you very much, Jan. How about it, Chuck Albright, over there in central part of Florida? How is life treating you in the villages?
Well, today we got very cloudy today, a lot of frog stranglers here. As you know, the villages where I live is by Ocala, and we are considered the largest retirement center in the world. We have 85,000 people, and they live in about 47,000 homes. And right now, it's raining cats and dogs outside my window, and it's a balmy 79 degrees. So if anybody comes up my way, please come on over. We have 50 golf courses and 12 country clubs to go have a lot of fun in their swimming pools.
Okay, Chuck, thanks for your report. Now let's move up to Roaring Gap, North Carolina, Captain Steve Thompson. Speaking of golf courses, how's everything out on Old Bow?
Oh, everything is just great up here. And our motto here is that Roaring Gap is where the heavens kiss the peaks. We have our daily rain shower that keeps everything so absolutely green and perfect. And all three golf courses here are in just an excellent condition. Just championship golf courses that are just beautiful to play, just great. The temperature outside right now is 69 degrees, and the high today was 78. Just a beautiful place, and we'd love to see all of you here visiting us in Roaring Gap.
Thanks, Steve. And listeners, this is Bill Joseph coming to you from the Grand Valley, Grand Junction, Colorado, on the western slope of the Rocky Mountains, where today the temperature was 91 degrees, the humidity 20%, which is a little high. We're hoping for an afternoon shower. And now over to the newest member of our cast, Millie Peary. Hello, Millie.
Hello, Bill, and to all the hosts. I'm so happy to be with you tonight. I'm here in Coral Gables, and not too far from where, once again, the New Eastern will be headquartered. I'm so excited about the prospects of this happening again real soon. I'll be the first in line with my application for whatever, wherever, whenever they want me. Thank you, folks.
Okay. Hey, Bill, before you go any further, we've got Jim Hart, and he's way up there in Martha's Vineyard. Hello, Jim.
Yes, I am, Neil. I'm sorry I got hung up here, and I'm finally really, well, you folks have been so good with us. Should I say something about Martha's Vineyard, where we have regular seasonal influx of tourists? This is Jim Hart. We're glad you tuned in for tonight's broadcast. This week's show, our host us will bring you Remembering Old Miami. Since Eastern played a big part in Miami history, we thought we would be interested in making in many Miami landmarks that were there in the old days, but no longer part of the Miami scenery or Miami activity. If you lived or ever worked where you may remember the places, events, people, buildings, airports, restaurants, theaters, and much more, they're only memories right now. Let's take a break and listen to an Eastern Airlines commercial.
Take a second now, look up in the sky, can't you see the blue there? That's an Eastern plane flying through the sky, shouldn't that be you there?
You gotta believe, it's for you. You gotta believe, things come true. You gotta believe and look it up now. Eastern, look it up now. Look it up, look at you. And you gotta believe.
Folks, our show tonight is Remembering Old Miami. I recently had the chance, when I say recently, just last week, I had the chance to visit Miami and had a chance to visit what we used to say our old stomping grounds. And boy, was I surprised to find bits and parts of the old Miami that I remembered still standing, many hidden by surrounding buildings or architectural changes in design and color. After parking in front of the first house my parents owned, I can see in my mind much of what I was doing in the neighborhood. Friends with whom I played with, they now call it hanging with. That's cool, or was it neat back in those days? Let's start out in the 40s. That's when I arrived in Miami, 1944. But in 1940, the population of Miami was 172,172 people by the 1940 U.S. Census. English was spoken by 99.9% of the population, and only 5% of the population was noticeably overweight. Over 92% of the population was white. The Dade County Courthouse was by far the tallest building in Miami. It was a landmark that could be seen for miles from land and sea. Every year, migratory buzzards roosted on top of the courthouse. The local bad guys, as they were called, roosted in the Dade County Jail, which was located at the top of the courthouse. Birds of a feather, we say. Bill?
You will remember these birds included the Cash Brothers gang, Virgil, Fred, and Ray Cash, along with Long John Fulford. They terrorized Miami during the late 40s and early 50s. You may also remember two other Miami thugs, Wesley Biggs and Freddie DeMeritt, who were constantly in trouble with the law. Al Capone had his home on one of the Venetian Isles. You knew that Miami's untreated raw sewage went directly into the Miami River or Biscayne Bay. Getting caught in traffic by a drawbridge going up over the Miami River on a hot, humid day was to be avoided if possible. All kinds of interesting things could be seen floating by. Miami's garbage was burned in a huge incinerator with a tall brick chimney that could be seen and smelled for miles. But this was offset by the wonderful smells of baking bread provided by the Wholesome Bakery on US 1 South. And at Christmas time, Wholesome Bakery provided Miami's most beautiful Christmas decoration panorama along US 1. How about Chock Full and Let's Coffee on 36th Street and about Northwest 2nd Avenue?
Well, we all remember the sticky gunk on cars from planes spraying for mosquitoes and fruit flies. And your car was painted by Johnny and Mac by the railroad track, and it had Smitty's mufflers with cutouts so that as to avoid the ears of the cops. And do you remember the hairy knobs we had on our steering wheels with your favorite pinup of Betty Grable or Rita Hayworth? I had my girlfriend's on my steering knob. It made it easier to turn the car with your left hand using the knob and the right arm around your steady, who was nearly sitting in your lap next to you. In the early 50s, when TV was in the infancy, Munch TV was a big retailer of the round tube. I remember their showroom on Biscayne Boulevard, and that's where my family bought our first TV, kind of round screen as I recall. Chalk Airlines and Goodyear Blimp based on Watson Island. And the entire family rejoiced when in 1942, Captain Eddie Rickenbacker, World War II fighter pilot, Medal of Honor winner, and America's Ace of Aces, and his B-17 crew were found alive after floating in a life raft for 27 days in the Pacific Ocean. They had crashed at sea during a World War II mission, and no one had a clue where they might be. Millie?
Whether southeast or southwest, 8th Street was actually called 8th Street, not Calle Ocho. Anything on southwest 8th Street after 107th Avenue was a rock pit or a farm. 41st Street in Miami Beach was actually called 41st Street, not Arthur Godfrey Road. No one had ever heard of Arthur Godfrey. The Judah Tuttle Causeway took you to 36th Street in Miami to Arthur Godfrey Road on the beach side. Alton Road, Lincoln Road, Collins Avenue, and Washington Avenue were the main shopping roads on the beach, and at the south end was the now famous South Beach. Many kids my age learned to swim in the community pool known as South Beach Pool near the once popular Miami Beach Kennel Club. The major north-south artery for Miami was 7th Avenue and 27th Avenue. North of 79th Street, it was a two-lane rock road all the way to Broward County line. Biscayne Boulevard was a beautiful Royal Palm Line Boulevard. Some early hotels along this boulevard were the Everglades and the McAllister. Flagler Street divided Miami into northeast, southeast, northwest, and southwest, and the avenues and the streets.
Well, you know, we had some attractive buildings on Biscayne Boulevard where the Sears and Roebuck building at 14th Street and Biscayne Boulevard was. And we had the Miami Daily News building a few blocks south. Now, Kendall Drive was known as the Road to Nowhere. There were horse farms on West Kendall Drive and Sunset Drive. And west of the airport was an area we liked to visit and watch the submarine races with our favorite girlfriend or boyfriend companion. I-95, Florida Turnpike, and Alligator Alley did not exist. And there were only two roads out of Miami to northern destinations, US 1 and Route 27, a.k.a. Road 27, which went up through Central Florida, Okeechobee Road. Chuck?
US 1 was named Biscayne Boulevard, where it passed through most of Miami. It became Brickell Avenue for a short distance south of downtown Miami. As it continued further south, it passed through Homestead and passed the famous Last Chance Saloon, so named because it was the last sign of civilization until Jewfish Creek, some 35 miles straight ahead south. There were trillions of mosquitoes along this desolate stretch between Homestead and Jewfish Creek. You prayed that your car would not get a flat tire or break down or run out of gas. Jewfish Creek, all the way to Key West, US 1 was called the Overseas Highway. Watching the charter fish boats come in at Pier 5 at Biscayne Boulevard was to die for. An outing. You could buy fresh fish right off these boats. Feeding the pigeons at Bayfront Park was a big deal too. The ship Perez Valinar grounded near Bayfront Park in the bandshell at Bayfront Park. During World War II, hotels on Miami Beach were used to rehab GIs returning from the war. Chief among them was the Fleetwood Hotel and the Venetian Hotel. Crossing the Venetian Causeway, you had to pay a toll of 10 cents. Blacks were off the beach no later than 6 p.m. on the weekends and not allowed on the beach during the weekends. Some hotels on the beach catered to Gentiles only. Many took the cheapest transportation to the beach available, jitneys, which cost 25 cents just one way. Dan?
Restaurants and theaters. Wow, what memories. Let's talk about food. The best Italian restaurants were Valenti's and Leo's for pizza. The best steakhouse was the Robin Hood Inn. The best seafood restaurant was the Chesapeake Inn. Mrs. Lee's Shrimp Place on Northwest 7th Avenue and 21st Street served the best fried shrimp and key lime pie in Miami, bar none. Great chili dogs were served at Sloppy Joe's in downtown Miami. Smitty's Barbecue, Northeast Miami Avenue and 36th Street. There was the Pig and Whistle, Northwest 7th Avenue. Kremp's Mile Long Hot Dogs on Northwest 7th Avenue and 45th Street. Howard Johnson's served fried clams and 27 ice cream flavors. Jumbo Frank's. There was also Joe Stone Crabs, Miami Beach, and the Lighthouse, Rusty Pelican restaurants. Both of those, the Lighthouse and Rusty Pelican, burned down. However, Rusty Pelican has reopened in the year 2011. Mm. That happens to be one of my very favorites. There was only a Gulf station on US 1 across from Shorty's. There was the Pig Trail Inn on 5th Street, Miami Beach, and the Red Coach Inn on Biscayne Boulevard, perhaps you may recall the longest bar in the world at Red Coach Inn. There was also the Tropical Grill, Miami Beach, at the end of the County Causeway. There was a great fried chicken restaurant serving chicken in a basket with honey. I don't recall the name of it, but it was located in the North Miami area in US 1. Perhaps one of our listeners recalls the name and will let us know. Miami's only fast food chain was Royal Castle. Fresh cooked hamburgers at 9 cents and birch beer for a nickel and served in a huge frosty mug. You can pig out for under a dollar, imagine. Royal Castle was located on Flagler Street, and Walgreens also had its first store there. If I recall, it was even it was close to the buses. They had their main connections on Flagler Street.
That's right.
It is also amazing the famous theater and stage shows. Olympia Theater was and still is located across from Walgreens on Flagler. Don Julio's Mexican restaurant was on 20th Street, Miami. I believe it's about time for another Eastern TV commercial. How about it?
Let's take a plane, laugh at snow, storms, and rain to Miami, where life is champagne. You fly from frost to flowers in just 8 hours. When you travel east and scrape silver fleas, you make the clouds a byway. When you take heaven's highway, in a moment, your fondest dreams complete. Fly from frost to flowers in just 8 hours when you travel on the great silver
fleas. Wow. You know, apparently nightclubs and bars, this is the section that left for Jim Hart to talk about, because, of course, I'm very familiar with all of these places. Colonel Lou Mercer's nightclub, the Vagabond Club, Les Violins, was a real hot spot. A gay nightclub called the Jewel Box was an even hotter spot. The Clover Club, the Copacabana Supper Club, the Beachcomber Nightclub, Minsky's Strip Joint on Miami Beach, 5th Street Pier, Zolita's Club on Biscayne Boulevard, Zissin's Bowery, Sheila the Peeler and her big snake, Mr. James Club on Northwest 2nd Avenue and 36th Street, Casey's Oasis in the heart of the Irish section of Miami Beach, Mike's Friendly Bar on the Bird Road near US 1, Jimmy's Hurricane on Bird Road, and the Miami Moon.
Hey, our Jim. Jim, I think our censor did not cut this paragraph out.
I'm telling you.
Oh, you're great. Our parents took us to see some great stage shows at the Olympic Theater. We wondered why they suddenly became quiet and or why they changed the subject when we asked them why they wouldn't take us to see the shows at the Jewel Box, Zorita's, or Sheila's. Parents could let their kids travel on the city buses without cause to be concerned about their safety, as most homes in Miami were unlocked during the day, as well as the cars are the same. You know, it's the same way in Martha's Vineyard right now. Most homes were climate controlled by the oscillating fan, and air conditioning was only found in commercial shops and hotels. Bill?
Radio and television stations. Miami had only 4 radio stations, WQAM, WIOD, WGBS, and WKAT. They were all AM. FM did not exist yet. The word television was not in our vocabulary. Radio was the undisputed king of in-home entertainment. Speaking of king, Larry King was once on WIOD radio. Larry King was once a columnist for the Miami Herald. Larry King was arrested in Miami for passing bad checks. Louis Wolfson, the Jacksonville junk millionaire, put Larry King in jail. Barry Gray hosted Miami's first radio talk show. Country and Western DJ Uncle Martin, playing Wabash Cannonball by Roy Acuff and great bluegrass music by Bill Monroe, his favorite two artists. Jerry Wishner dances and his late night radio show on WINZ. Listening to sexy talking sleepy time gal on late night radio and her imaginary love affair with singer Tony Martin. Do you all remember the Kiss of Fire?
Hey, Bill, I can play, I can sing you sleepy time gal. You remember that?
That was before my time, Neil.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I had to get that in. Go ahead, Bill.
Mom's listening to Don McNeil's Breakfast Club in the morning. Oh, and don't forget the kids watch Kukla, Fran, and Ollie on the round TV tube and Buffalo Bob Smith and Clarabelle the Clown.
And, Jim, I'm surprised that you didn't mention the most famous nightclub that existed in Miami Springs. It would be very familiar to all Eastern crew members, and it was owned by an Eastern pilot, I believe. Somebody can help me with that later on, the name of it.
Okay, I've got it right now. Ken's.
That's what it is. I remember now. And I remember Ken.
I had my time there, too.
Yes, I think we all spent many times and have many stories there that we can't even relate.
We can see our angles there, as a matter of fact. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay. At other times during the week, the entire family might be sprawled out on the floor in front of the radio listening to Amos and Andy, Henry, Aldrich, Duffy's Tavern, Burns and Allen, Fred Allen, Life of Riley, Lum and Abner, Phil Harris and Alice Faye, Jack Benny, The Great Gildersleeve, Fibber McGee and Molly, Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy, It Pays to Be Ignorant, Suspense, The Whistler, Mr. and Mrs. North, Boston Blackie, Superman, Captain Midnight, Jack Armstrong, Sergeant Preston of the Yukon, Inner Sanctum, The Lone Ranger, The Green Hornet, The Shadow, The Thin Man, Gangbusters, Mary Noble, Backstage Wife, Guiding Light, Portia Faces Life, One Man's Family, Lux Presents Hollywood, Mr. District Attorney, Queen for a Day, Big John and Sparky, Gray Bureau Heater, and they live in Miami Beach, H.B. Kaltenborn, Walter Winchell, Bill Stern, Sports Legend, Bill Crosby, Eddie Arnold, of course, and the top 10 songs of the week. WTVJ Channel 4 was Miami's only TV station. WTVJ's Ralph Renick was Miami's first news anchor, and WTVJ's Jack Cummings was Miami's first sports anchor. Alex Gibson, the laid-back afternoon movie host on WTVJ. Wayne Weaver the weatherman, was the WTVJ's team. Jackie Gleason was a tremendous public relations entertainer for Miami, with many of his TV shows originating from Miami Beach Convention Center. Arthur Godfrey was another personality giving strong support to the Miami area and his connections with Captain Eddie and Eastern Airlines. And I remember frequently he commuted between New York and Miami in his VTOL Bonanza, whose N number was familiar to all of us and who we would frequently say hello to as we flew up and down the coastline and would hear him call in. Chuck?
Ed Markham Down Lane, Cars, Austin Burkhead Clothes, Jack O'Connell of the Municipal Auto Sales, Hawking They Wears on TV, Wears Much Fun to Watch on the show they sponsor. Don't forget, everybody should own a TV, Munch TV on Biscayne Boulevard. Actually watching a live broadcast of the University of Miami football game, watching Whitley Campbell, the 165-pound University of Miami star fullback, dazzling the crowd, stunning the opposition with his unbelievable runs, and probably under the coaching of Andy Gustafson. Losing your TV picture and sound completely whenever a plane flew overhead, a real problem for those living on a major flight path from the Miami International Airport, MIAD. Millie?
And I say go Canes. Okay, now I'm talking about teenage activities and attractions. Teen dances were at the Little River Youth Center. Colonel Jim's Drive-In and Billy's Drive-In was on the 79th Street Causeway. Kelly's Drive-In was on Lejeune Road. Pally's Big Wheel, the gorgeous car hops at Scotty's Drive-In at Sunny Isles, Dairy Queen Blizzard's A&W Drive-In Restaurants, the diving board at Matheson Hammock Pond, Venetian Pools and Caves in Coral Gables, Bill Ross Frosty Freeze Ice Cream Shop in Alapatta, Tyler's Restaurant in Alapatta, Saturday Night Student Dances at Tech High School, and Sambo's in the Gables. There was weekend family picnics on Miami Beach when you just drove along A1A until you found a quiet spot, parked your car along the side of the road, taking care not to get stuck in the sand, which everyone did at one time or another, and tried to avoid the sand spurs as the kids raced to the beach. There were no hotels, condos, lifeguards, or crowds. You had no idea at the time what a great place Miami was to live and grow up in. Oh, my goodness, the Nudie Beach, just north of Baker's Hollover.
I knew where that was.
Oh, yeah, and definitely that was a spot for people watching, okay? And then not too far was Cook's Casino on Miami Beach, and that was exactly the spot to hit after that. Big public swimming pool with wooden decks at the south end of the beach where I learned to swim.
Miami Beach. Do you remember the South Beach area was just below 5th Street? We had the Ronnie Plaza Hotel and radio station WKAT on West Avenue in Miami Beach. We always used to say that the people on South Beach were older than the building. Coastal blackouts during World War II, ships torpedoed in sight of the beach, black goop from sinking ships making swimming impossible. The top half of automobile headlights had to be painted black to make them less visible to the enemy aircraft. And during World War II, troops were quartered at all the hotels for training. Gas and food rationing stamps were handed out during World War II. The Olympic-sized pool at the McFadden Duval Hotel, sneaking in the swimming pools at the fancy Miami Beach hotels. Do you remember getting thrown out of swimming pools at the fancy Miami Beach hotels again? And the new Fontainebleau Hotel was one of the world's finest hotels. Gar Wood, his mansion on Fisher Island, and his huge plywood boat. And do you remember these? Embry-Riddle School of Aviation, stock car races at Hialeah and Medley Speedways, stock car drivers Bobby Jones, and Herb Tillman, Amelia Earhart field drag races, and Bayfront Park submarine races.
I remember we went to the movies, and the audiences were polite and quiet. If a girl agreed to come and sit with you in the balcony, it meant some smooching was sure to occur. And, of course, we all loved going to the movies at Rosetta's Theater in the Little River. Shores, Muver, in Miami Shores? Center Theater in Edison Center, the Strand Theater in Miami, Dade and Regent Theaters in Alapatta, Mayfair, Baltimore, Tivoli and Capitol Movie Theaters, the Rex, Cobb, Lincoln State and Paramount Theaters. Wow, the Olympia Theater in downtown Miami, where in 1956, a relatively unknown young rockabilly singer named Elvis Presley performed to a sold-out audience of hysterical teenage fans. Your parents and he was just a fad. That's what they said. And that within a few years, no one will remember who Elvis Presley is or was. Oh, yeah, right.
Also remember Miami Edison, Miami Jackson, and Miami High were the big three high schools, while Ponce de Leon, Tech High, and Miami Beach High were the small three high schools. Your grandparents knew that Dade County Agricultural High School was built in 1915. It was rebuilt and renamed Miami Edison High School in 1932 to commemorate the death of the brilliant American inventor, Thomas A. Edison. Andrew Jackson Elementary and Junior High Schools later became Andrew Jackson High School. In 1948, it was renamed Miami Jackson to avoid confusion with Jacksonville's Andrew Jackson High School. Many working for Eastern Airlines came from Lindsay Hopkins Vocational School on 14th Street and 2nd Avenue.
Including myself.
They have, and that's Neil, right?
That's right.
They have an aviation mechanic school that later became George T. Baker School of Aviation. Who could forget Mr. William Bill Smith, the head of the aviation school? Bill, have you some additional aviation-related information that you can tell us about?
Yes, I do, Jan. The Kendall Flying School at the old Tamiami Airport out on Tamiami Trail, and owner FAA designee Mary Gaffney, who probably trained more EAL pilots than any other flight school or instructor. She was also Women's National Aerobatic Champion for 3 years running in her Pitts Special. And don't forget South Florida as the area that Curtis Pitts built his famous airplane, the Pitts Special. All public schools in Miami were racially segregated. Drugs, gangs, and violence were unheard of in Miami schools. Respect for authority, good sportsmanship, and good grooming were expected, not optional. The traditional Thanksgiving Day football game between Miami Edison and Miami High was an event of monumental proportions. It often drew more fans than any of the University of Miami football team games. In 1951, Miami-Jackson High School was the first high school in Miami to defeat Miami Senior High in football.
Bill, we shop for groceries and various goodies at A&P Grocery Stores, Frederick's Market and Edison Center, Grable's Bakery, Grand Union and Quick Check Stores, Shell City Superstore, Brady's The Little Farm Store, Moorhead's Market on Northwest 7th Avenue and 41st Street, Gregory's on Northwest 12th Avenue and 38th Street, Dave's Poultry on Northwest 7th Avenue and 45th Street. You picked out a live chicken and Dave would ethically euthanize it and dress it for you on the spot, okay? A nice roast chicken for Sunday dinner for a very big deal then. Pickett's on 36th Street across the Moore Park Grocery and Meats on Northwest 12th Avenue and 45th Street. We had milk delivered at home and or bought ice cream and other dairy products from White Belt Dairy. Remember the tornado that hit White Belt Dairy? Wives Dairy, Graham's Dairy, Dressel's Dairy, MacArthur's Dairy, Home Milk, Seal Test Milk, Dolly Madison Ice Cream. Mmm.
Thank you.
Remember that beautiful song? It's called Moon Over Miami. And, Margaret, I think you might be able to help us out with the lyrics.
Well, I'd be happy to do that, Captain Neil. Folks, do you remember these lyrics? Moon over Miami, shine on my love and me, so we can stroll beside the roll of the rolling sea. Moon over Miami, shine on as we begin a dream or two that may come true when the tide comes in. Hark to the song of the smiling troubadours. Hark to the throbbing guitars. Hear how the waves offer thunder
on the radio
after each song to the stars. Moon over Miami, you know we're waiting for a little love, a little kiss on Miami shore.
You know, that song was written back in 1935 by Joe Burke and Edgar Leslie. The most popular recording of Moon Over Miami was done by Eddie Duchin in 1936 and his orchestra. Eddie Duchin and his orchestra, I remember that, listening to that beautiful song, Living in Miami. Vaughn Monroe played this, or recorded the song in 1945. And Bill Haley and the Comets even set the lyrics and the music to rock and roll. And that's the story of Moon Over Miami. Chuck, continue on with our story about Miami.
Why, sure. You know, we bought cars from Packer Pontiac Southland, Don Allen Chevrolet, J.D. Ball Ford, Spencer Dodge, and Anthony Abraham Chevrolet. Various used car lots were all over 36th Street. All Florida rental cars had an E license tag, for instance. A Florida automobile tag also reflected county population size. Dade County 1, Duval 2, Liberty 67. Also, license tags depicted the weight of your car, 1, 1W, 1WW, and so forth. Miami and Tropicare drive-in theaters, sneaking in the drive-in theater by hiding in the car trunk, making out at the drive-in theater, rarely making out at the drive-in theater at all. Miami International Airport Depot was called MIAD. Tamiami Airport was on Tamiami Trail in Browns Airfield. At Opa-locka Air Base, planes towed targets for World War II fighter pilot practice. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, it became the Military Command Center. I was chief flight instructor for TERS Air School of Aviation and awarded the first Eastern Airlines contract for training of flight engineers as required by the new FAR requirements. Steve, you have something there?
Yes, I do, and you're talking about the automobile dealers, J.D. Ball Ford. I had the pleasure of working there for 3 months before my class started with Eastern. And one of the things that I learned there was the Hull-Dobbs method of selling cars, which meant that if somebody brought in a trade-in and no contract was reached to sell them a new car, their keys got thrown up on top of the roof, and they had to go get a new set of car keys in order to get their car back to wherever they came from.
Well, Steve, I bought my first brand new Chevrolet convertible from Anthony Abraham.
Wow, that was quite quite an experience selling automobiles from a new car dealer back then. And I remember Cockroach Corner, also at the Miami International Airport, which was located at the northwest corner of the airport in Miami Springs. Every transport from every airline in the world could be found there, so it seemed. The British Comet, the Imperial Airways Connie, still stands out in my mind, for some reason. The U.S. Air Force 435th Troop Carrier Wing Reserve was just around the corner from Cockroach Corner. I spent many drill weekends under the command of Colonel John B. McBride, also an Eastern pilot. Eastern, Pan Am, and National Airlines Rickenbacker Causeway opened in 1947, and the toll was 15 cents. Crandon Park Zoo and free parking on Key Biscayne, Pan Am's airport, at Dinner Key, and Captain John B. McBride could fall asleep with the snap of a finger, and would wake up also with the sound of the gear coming down.
We could have a show on John McBride. Folks, if you've never met John McBride, you can visualize Hoss on Bonanza with a uniform, an Eastern uniform on, and that would be McBride. Margaret?
Yes, and I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Steve.
Margaret?
Okay. Well, you know, here's some more memories. Biscayne Kennel Club, Miami Marine Stadium, and hydroplane races. And, oh, those delicious Dixie and Velvet Cream donuts. Do you remember those? How about the Monkey Jungle, Lindsay Lumber, Jackson Memorial Hospital when it was only one building, Victoria and Abbey Hospitals, St. Francis Hospital on Miami Beach, Jackson Byron's or just J. Byron's, Sears and Roebuck on 13th Street and Biscayne Boulevard, Burdine's, Richards, McCrory's, the Five and Dime Store. You could find anything at Rayleigh Millen's Hardware on Flagler Street. John the Magic Man was a tricks and magic store paradise. Jefferson Auto Stores and a little motor scooter they sold for only $149.95, and they called it the Doodle Bug. Every young boy wanted one. Now the Ferris Wheel atop Burdine's, Robert's Western Wear and OK Feed Store in the Gables, Red Cross Drug Department Store in downtown Miami, Tropical Drive-In Swap Meets, Claude, Red's Peppers Picnics at Tropical Park, and Tropical Park when it was a racetrack. Jim?
Golden Golf and Goonie Golf across from where the falls was built. Getting a flat tire from hitting a huge land crab crossing Old Cutler Road. Bill Haas. Bill, I remember, I couldn't believe how much he was so concerned about getting bitten by rattlesnakes, cobras, crates, and assorted other poisonous snakes at his Miami's Serpentarium on U.S. 1 South. Sunday, country dancing at Alabama Jack's. The Kitchen Hotel, later called Emery Riddle, on North 27th Avenue. Moore Park and Joe Mason Park, Lemon City. Weekends at the Coral Gables Venetian Pool with all its rocks and caves were a kid's delight, especially if you went with your gal and you could sneak a kiss or two in the privacy of one of those caves. That was great. Let Live and Let Live drugstore in Allopath. Hawkins Bicycle Shop, Dr. Elam Arendt and Rents, Allopath. The huge painting of the Lone Ranger on the exterior wall of Merida Bakery next to Robert E. Lee Jr. High School. The Regal Brewery. The Coca-Cola bottling plant on Northwest 36th Street. Dexter's and Rustic Roller Skating Rinks. The Strand Theater and the movie serials playing on the weekends with popcorn, would you believe, at 5 cents a bag. The Strand Roller Skating Rink, right next door to the Northwest 7th Avenue. Jan?
You know, before Jan tells a little bit more about Miami history, I remember Robert E. Lee Junior High School. Those windows would always be open, and right across the street, as a matter of fact, I was there last week, was the Merida Bakery, and boy, did that smell come through those windows. It was fabulous. And you know the reason why on their wall they had a painting of the Lone Ranger? Can you guess?
No.
No clue.
What is your guess, Jan?
No clue.
Oh, no clue. Okay, that's not the correct answer, but it was because... on the days that the Lone Ranger was playing on the radio, it was sponsored by Merida Bread.
Oh.
The show was sponsored by Merida Bread. Jan, what do you got about Coral Castle?
Speaking about Old Miami, there was Coral Castle, the Old Miami Marina, Edison Center, Little River, Alapata and the Moore Cafeteria, Musa Isle Indian Village, Clotten's Isle Island, Reynolds Park, and Rare Bird Farm. Engel's Drugstore in the Grove, Dinner Key, and the famous Pan Am Clipper Terminal. Newman's Funeral Home on Miami Beach was between two nightclubs, the Miami Springs Villas, the Public Library in Bayfront Park at the end of Flagler Street, the Rock Garden at Bayfront Park, Les Rhodes Band at the Olympia, the Miami Seahawks Pro Football Team, Miami Drum and Bugle Corps, the Pawn Twirling Champion Bill Allen teaching baton at Moore Park, the Trolley Car Ride across the causeway, Mike Gordon's Tackle and Bait Shack before he opened his restaurant, Men's Grill at Burdine's, Sinclair's Grill adjacent to the old Herald Building, Richard's Bargain Basement, the big ACL train station on 7th Avenue tracking through Hialeah, Seaboard Railroad Station, and the Silver Meteor, Miami Air Depot making weapons for World War II, the Miami Daily News, and the Miami Daily News Building. Are any of these names familiar to our listeners?
Well, they certainly are to me, Jan. I can also remember the Miami Country Club, golf course between Miami River and 20th Street, the Liberty City Jitneys that came down Northwest 12th Avenue, the streetcars, the streetcar on Northwest 7th Avenue in World War II. They actually had streetcars back in those days. And it cost a nickel to ride the streetcar. Banana supply and trucks with truck signs. Yes, we have no bananas. Kicks and pop cola. 16 ounces for the same price as a 12-ounce Pepsi. Clouds moved across the ceiling at the Olympia Theater and live stage with big-name attractions like Sonny Tufts, Veronica Lake, Mickey Rooney, and millions of jugglers and magicians were on the stage at the Olympia Theater between the main show, the cartoons, and then the stage show. Hartley's was right next to the Olympia Theater. It was a downtown place for women's fashions. The Venetian Causeway only had a cost of 10 cents that you pitched in to the toll booth. Bus riding all over the county with paper transfers getting punched. The beach on Virginia Key was for blacks. Jose Alemán buying the south half of Key Biscayne. How did you get your money out of Cuba, Jose? In suitcases, senor? Was his answer. Grinnell's Park Hill, the highest point in Dade County. Moore Park night softball leagues. Notable players included Sandy Dees, Buster Ziegler, and Maggie McGee, Doc Winkle, and world-class pitcher Herb Dudley of the Clearwater Bombers. How about Wynwood Park, very close to where I lived, where you could find people like Lee Corso and Jimmy Roundtree? Both would become All-American football players. I went to high school with both of them. I was in their class at Robert E. Lee Jr. High School as well, on Northwest 5th Avenue and about 32nd Street. Lee Corso and I competed for the heart of Jimmy Roundtree's little sister, Janie. Those were the days.
Man, you're ancient.
79th Street Causeway going to 71st Street Beach. Walt Disney Studio on Northwest 17th Street and 28th Avenue. Warning signs about roasting marshmallows with oleander sticks. The aforementioned Marita Bakery on Northwest 6th Avenue. Great smells. Monroe's Grocery Store. Burdine's installing the state's first escalator. The Parrot Jungle. Absolutely nothing west of the airport until Doral. Orange Bowl. High school football Thursday nights. University of Miami Friday nights. Bill Baggs, Jack Bell, Jacko Foed, Vic Dunaway, and Salty Mallets, Salty Says, and their columns in the Miami Herald and the Miami Daily News newspapers. Having a paper route with the Miami Herald or the Miami Daily News.
Steve?
I'm sorry, I got called away there just for a second. Our page?
We're on 14. Page 14.
14.
At the bottom of the page.
I'm sorry.
It's right beside your name, Steve.
It says
hey,
on the left-hand side. Folks, I guess by now you realize we're reading a great deal of this. As
I do. I have found myself, and pardon me for this.
Okay, that's okay.
And, hey, listeners, we're sure you have Miami memories that we have not listed during the show. So if you'd like to call in now, we'd be happy to hear from you. Did you ever hear go to Miami for training in the early days?
Well, Steve, before you go any further, we do have a caller on 904, area code 904. We're going to open the mic. Area code 904, are you listening?
Yes, sir. This is my first attempt. I keep forgetting, and I just now found the note to myself. I don't want to bore with repetition. Have you had anyone call in who attended Eastern Airlines Training School in 1957?
Golly, Pete, we're going to talk about that. Would you stay with us just for just a few minutes? Okay, very good. Steve, would you give us the call-in numbers? Do you have those?
Yes.
And give the callers the call-in numbers.
Yes, we would like to hear from you. Where did you stay? Where did you eat? And where was your training held? Do you remember the building number? And who was your instructor? How long was your training? Now, these and other stories are all welcome. We want to hear from you. Give us a call at 213-816-1611. Or toll free at 877-572-1861. Now, let me repeat those numbers again. 213-816-1611 or toll free 877-572-1861. And it just so happens that I attended a class of July 1st in 1957 in my flight training class.
Well, yeah, we'll talk about that. But the caller on area code 904, what is your name?
Barbara. Coston, then, C-O-S-T-O-N. It's Barbara Hall, H-A-L-L, in Stark, Florida.
Okay, you're not too far away from us, Barbara. What do you recall about the training that were you a flight attendant?
Yes, and Miami Springs Villas was where we took the training. But I have a lot of fun in this day and time telling all these women's livers about the rules back then, which I think were great. But I could only fly. I didn't even quite fly a year because you had to get quit when you got married. And so many of us young single stewardesses there, as Miami International was the home base for many, many aircraft companies, as you know. And so Homestead Air Force Base was right nearby with all these single young jet pilots. And I married. My husband flew the B-47 there. But what I find so funny to tell gals nowadays that makes their mouth just drop open is I can definitely remember being told in training school that no matter how thin or slender we thought we were required to wear a girdle. They didn't want any flopping fannies going down the aisle. And I was so tiny, I had to shop all over Miami Springs trying to find a girdle small enough. And we could only wear our hair one of two ways, you know, up in a chignon or short, very short. And, golly, I just thought of this at the last minute. I'm not really prepared that much, but they measured us up one side and down the other. You were grounded if you gained weight. And, oh, gosh, just all kind of things like that that are, you know, I find young people today just gasp, you know, at the thought. You mean they measured you? And you had to... You know, grounded if you gained too much weight and all of.
That's right. You had to go through a weight check too, didn't you?
Yes, I don't remember ever having done that. Like I said, I didn't even get to fly a year because I met my husband and decided to get married, and that was that.
What did that have to do with it?
Well, you could never have been married.
Well, I flew with a lot of them that were married.
Oh, really? Because I understood the rules then, and because when I checked in at Eastern and said I was going to go get married, we said, well, I guess you know you cannot work for Eastern again. And
you know, I would give you a couple of names, but I don't think they would mind because the ones that I knew are no longer with us. But at any rate, yeah, there were a few that I think the pilots knew who they were, and it was held very secret. But where did you buy your first? Did you have to buy your first uniform, Barbara, or was it issued to you?
I don't remember having to pay anything. I don't know. I still have my old checkbook. I still have my complete uniform in storage somewhere, and you know, all kind of the badge thing that you put up in the aircraft, your name and all that. And
Barbara, this is Jim Hart up on Martha's Vineyard talking now.
Mm-hmm.
I joined the company also in 1957, and I'm wondering if you remember a lady by the name of Mary Lassiter.
That sounds vaguely familiar, one that. Like I said, I didn't prepare before I picked up the phone and tried to get in at least before it was over with.
Sure.
But one gal that was married, and it was kept secret because her husband had been lost his life in a Eastern accident. So she was allowed to. Her name was Laurie, and doggone, I wish I could think of her last name. Robinson, Laurie Robinson. She flew many years, and so then they disbanded that business of having to quit at age 35, so she flew for many years on. But she was from Moultrie, Georgia, and I can't stand it that I've lost contact with her.
Well, a lot of the airlines had that same rule or requirement that the flight attendants be single. I remember my first days of training on 36th Street in the old reservation building there and ticket counter building. If you recall, Eastern had their reservations, and you could go get your tickets right there at the building. But it was on the second floor that I took most of my training in that building. And down below the second floor was where the chief pilot and the managers of flying had their offices. And I recall that because Captain O.B. Bivens was on the first floor. And during the first week, I dropped by his office to say, thank you, Captain Bivens, for hiring me. I remember
you were a pilot or a flight attendant? Or?
I was a pilot. And I forgot what I was there for a minute. But I also remember the gory films they used to love to show during our training. And I had to close my eyes because everyone says, you're going to get sick when you see this film. It was a documentary about an airline crashing and the bodies strewn all over with deep wounds cut. Boy, it looked like it came right out of Hollywood with mangled limbs all over the field. Vince Curran was our instructor for the ditching classes and emergency first aid. A lot of folks remember Vince Curran. He might date back to your training days, Barbara.
Yeah. That name, again, sounds a little familiar, but after all, I'm going to be 78 in a few months. So a lot of living in between then, Air Force wife, traveling all over.
Well, your memory is very good.
I don't know.
Best I can recall, the class was about 2 weeks long in my training, and it included the aircraft flight manual and the company policies and procedures. And my first class on the aircraft was a Convair 440. Jim, you mentioned the fact that you took your training, I guess, up in New York area, didn't you? Or did
That's
you have
right.
to go to
Hartford,
Miami?
Hartford, Springfield, and the greater New England area. I tell you, it was fantastic. It was at a time when you'd fly by the seat of your pants.
Yeah.
But, you know, earlier someone mentioned about the Lone Ranger.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah.
Do you know why the Lone Ranger shot Tonto?
No.
Because he learned that Kemosabe meant son of a bitch.
That's pretty good.
Boy, that's an old one. That dates back to the 40s, Jim.
Well, I was very interested to receive emails. Like I say, this is really pretty much my first contact, but I had received some emails about the new one that they were rebuilding from old parts. not old parts, but totally rebuilding a, well, see there, I can't even say that now, 747 or so. Golden Falcon, was it? Heck, I can't.
Yeah, the
DC-7, Barbara.
Yeah, that's it, that's it. And they were asking for former stewardesses and different ones to come help, but I felt too tied down to try to get into that, and so I didn't. But I keep up with it and find it all so interesting. And I'm waiting for my little slender 10-year-old granddaughter to grow into my uniform, and then I want to dress her up and charge some TV station a bunch of money for having her on the dock, and then I'll clue her in on all the crazy rules and all that were back then. That was a good life then. By golly, it wasn't. I don't care. I'm not much into this women's live stuff.
Well, make sure you send us a picture of your granddaughter in your uniform.
Well, she's only 10 now, but anyway.
Chuck, let's ask Chuck about his training.
Well, most of my training I got to start out was in the Air Force, and then I got out of there, went to Pan Am, and Pan Am had a deal where if you came in, they had schools up in the top of their hangar where the officers were, and you went to school for 4 hours, and then you went down on the floor and helped some of the mechanics down there. For 4 hours, and you got, of course, you got 8 hours pay. And then we were fortunate, we had an FAA examiner right on the property. He had an office upstairs, and that's how I got my AMP license. Then I went over to Eastern, and I worked in the 727 DC-9 hangar, got my training there, and then moved on when they got the 1011 in the big hangar that the 1011s had. Over there on 36th Street, I stayed with that program for 12 and a half years, and then eventually I got a college degree and went into management. I was a tech service supervisor for almost 5 years, and then I was a manager at the engine shop. I had six shops working for me, about 150 people, and we did our training right there in the engine shop. I held some classes with some of the new mechanics that came in to learn the Eastern way of doing things.
Well, let's hear from Jan. Yeah.
Yes, my initial training was in reservations, 1957, as a matter of fact. Uh-huh. And believe it or not, it was in the break room or on the job training. Uh-huh. But I do want to go further when Res closed about a year and a half to 2 years later, because that was the start of the computer age, I was transferred out to the airport. Well, I was told to read the IATA ticketing manual in preparation for going out to the airport. My first day on the job was on a Sunday, the Sunday after Thanksgiving, which perhaps was the busiest Sunday of the year. And I was handed a drawer, and it said, this is your cash drawer with $50, and this is your validator die. So that was my training. And it was so exciting. I would love to go back there again. I got through it, and it was baptism by fire.
Mm-hmm.
Thoroughly enjoyed it.
Jan, was Mr. Lloyd your station manager at the time?
Hip Lloyd, yes.
Hip Lloyd.
Yes. And Hip was a lovely gentleman, and his wife, Ginny. They used to attend a lot of our get-togethers that we had in the Res and airport time. Bill, I understand that you were trained, or you were in Miami at some point?
Well, Jan, you know, I did my military service, and then I graduated from the University of South Florida and joined Eastern Airlines in a 6 months training in sales and service in Tampa with no guarantee of any position after the 6 months was over. My first assignment was as a station manager, probably one of the youngest station managers Eastern ever had in terms of time with the company. But you know, the training that I did was really courses that involved operations and sales. I was the trainee in some of these courses and the trainer in others. I was very active in the selection of Eastern employees who had a desire to move into management positions via the IMP and MMIP programs at that time. These were assessment center-oriented training exercises that several sales managers would conduct with these people that were identified in-house. They were all Eastern employees. How about Steve? You must have had your pilot training in Miami, right, Steve?
Yes, I did, Bill, and as I remember, it lasted about a month, and it began my first day of July 1st of 1957, and I remember the ground school, I think, was about 2 weeks, and I was newly married, and we stayed at a motel on Okeechobee Road right on the canal. It was a studio efficiency. And I remember every night coming home from the ground school, and my wife and I would study and learn the Morse code. And to this day, I only remember two letters, A and N. That's all that I remembered, but I remember spending hours on learning the Morse code because you had to pass a certain test before you could graduate from ground school. And that I remember vividly. And also, if Barbara's still listening, I don't know whether you were in a class of ditching training, which I have related on this show before once, but we were tied up to a pier on Biscayne Bay in a life raft. And one of the people in my class, a classmate, found the knife. And it kind of got out of his hand, and it cut the rope that tied the life raft to the dock. And of course, the wind took us right out on Biscayne Bay, and they had to call the Coast Guard to come in and get us. And Vince Curran was as mad as anybody that I have ever seen.
No, I don't remember any rough training like that at all. All I remember is very calm kind of things. I don't remember anything like that.
Oh, well, that would have been a fun part of your training had you been there that day, because it was a mixture of flight attendants and pilots. and that's my fondest memories of my flight training. And my flight training instructor was Swede Johnson.
Swede Johnson.
And my partner was M.C. Morgan.
I remember both of them, yeah.
Yes.
Steve, let's move
along.
Does
anybody remember Morse code to dot, 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 dash, 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 dot, dot, dot?
I remember. Yeah, I bluffed my way through Morse code. But let me get Millie and let her tell us about her training. Let me open the mic for Millie. Millie, are you there?
Yeah, I certainly am. And Barbara, like the hundreds of classes before me, Miami was a training center for all the flight attendants. I certainly remember my Eastern Airlines initial training, which was back in 1986. It was an intensive four-week, fast-paced movement conducted at the Hartley Building on 36th Street. I don't know if you trained there, too. I remember when Linda Simmons, our emergency training supervisor, welcomed us on the first day, and then thereafter making unexpected appearances when the class least expected it. And, of course, she actually wanted us to excel, and she wanted us to be proficient in all the subjects, and everything from our meticulous, polished personal business looks, as you well know, to being quick-witted and knowledgeable on all our emergency procedures on the six aircraft types that we had back then, which were the DC-9, the 727, the 757, the A300, the L-1011, and the DC-10. And so our training was so thorough that upon graduation, every single one of us understood very clearly our roles as representatives for Eastern Airlines, and there was no question about it. It was the toughest educational training experience I have ever assisted till today.
Mm.
And I can really safely tell you that when Joe Leonard pinned my wings on my Breen Bill Hare uniform, if you guys remember what Breen was all about, I was proud, but then I was so relieved. But the best part of my training that I really enjoyed was the in-flight cabin service training for the El Intermercado flights. That was a joy, and I thoroughly enjoyed that out of that four-week training. So I remember when my classmates or any of us, we were weighed in every four days, and if we were 1 ounce over that limit, we were sent home. A lot of people went home.
Yeah.
Another thing is they were expected the best out of us. The first day, obviously we had to go in with a business attire, and they looked at us from head to toe. Okay. The second day, we had a personal appearance day, which you sat down in front of your your instructor that they designated, and they looked at you from head to toe. And mine was pretty grueling because they looked at me and they said, you had a hard face. So they said, you need to cut that hair and you're going to have to get bangs. And I'm like, oh, I was so relieved. You know what? I just went up there and I said, no problem. I love makeovers. So
good attitude.
Remember that? I don't know also if I know we went to Ball Harbor on the third day, and we went to a lady named Winnie. Not Winnie. I think her name was Winnie, and she
Winnie
had
Gilbert.
A pink. Not Winnie. No, this is a lady who was at the Estee Lauder counter in Ball Harbor, and she was in charge of giving us that makeover. And a lot of flight attendants cried because so many beautiful manes were cut off. And it was back then when everybody had frosted hair, and that was pretty radical back then. Everyone from the guys to the girls had to actually get their hair dyed. So by the end of the day, you would see everybody crying. But they looked really good. I mean, we just absolutely. And, of course, it grew on us by day because our training was very, very intense. We didn't have time to think about it. We were constantly on our feet, on our toes, and they were there looking at us. I mean, head to toe every single morning, and we had to be tip-top shape.
Billy, can I break in here because we're about to run out of time.
Oh, certainly.
And I wanted to ask Luann about her training, and I believe Luann just came in, and I believe she had hers at Air Kentucky, her initial training. Luann, you want to tell us about that?
Well, thank you for asking, Captain Neil. You know, our training classes were held at the Golden Corral. You know, they sectioned off something in the back for us. We were just as proud as we could be that we were handpicked to be flight attendants for our beloved Air Kentucky Learjet. And believe you me, they spared no expense for us. Why, Air Kentucky, I recall, even negotiated a deal with Golden Corral so that we students got big old discounts on our lunches there. I just thought that was great. You can't find companies like that anymore. Now, Lordy, they sure did put us through some rigorous training sessions. Steve, I know you were talking about the ditching training, and as I recall, we did our emergency ditching training in the pool at the Y. Now, since none of us Kentucky flight attendants could swim a lick, they outfitted all of us with, I think, them little water wings, I think you call it. And in fact, today, every passenger on Air Kentucky has standard-issue water wings under their seats because of that. And, you know, we don't fly now over lakes and oceans. We just fly over little creeks and ponds, so that's all we need. Now, one other thing about our training, whereas you big airlines use them emergency, I think you call it emergency evacuation chutes, we as flight attendants for Air Kentucky, we were just taught to take a big old run and jump out of the plane on account of the fact that we're only 3 feet off the ground. But, you know, sadly, Captain Neil, some of our flight attendants did have to drop out of that program. They just couldn't conquer their fear of that three-foot-high jump. I mean, I don't understand it. But then it was mandated that we watch some of those really good VCR tapes about the Learjets, and it showed us how to stoop when we walked up and down the aisles, and, you know, then how to grab onto them seats when that turbulence occurred going over the hills. And after each exhausting training day, we stayed at that real fancy Motel 6 near the airport. And golly, we had those free breakfasts. That was given to us by the hotel in the morning. I mean, you can't live better than that, Captain Neil. And for those of us who persevered, we graduated at the end of the week. And we got a real nice framed certificate of completion. We even got a set of wings. And, you know, some of the flight attendants, they even had their failures pin their wings on them. And as you said earlier, those sure were the days, Captain Neil.
Well, I don't know what to say about that, Lou Ann, but it's not the same training that Eastern flight attendants receive, for sure. Folks, we're about to come to the end of our program, and before we finish, I wanted to read a letter that I just received from a United States congressman, the House of Representatives, dated July 31st, 2012, and his name is John Micah. Now, John, Congressman Micah is the representative of the district here in Jacksonville that I reside, and I'm a constituent, and we had some issues that Captain Bob Furman has been working on for years and years without response from anyone in Congress addressing some issues that we had back when Eastern was still flying and shortly after the Eastern went under. And they had never been debated or spoken in Congress the way they should have been addressed. And so we have been working, Captain Furman and myself and some others have been working on seeing if the Congress could actually address those issues. And when we have more time, we'll do that. But I just wanted to read you this letter. Congressman Micah, as you know, is the chairman of the Transportation Committee and Infrastructure in Washington. He said, "Dear Captain Holland, thank you for your letter regarding the 1989 labor dispute between former Eastern Airlines and its collective bargaining units. I have long regretted the way in which the company and its employees at the time were treated and the unfortunate demise of a fine airline. The company's bad business practices and the detrimental impact they had on so many hardworking people was very unfortunate. In response to your letter, I have instructed professional committee staff to gather information on the matter. In all honesty, I believe it will be very difficult to go back and relitigate or seek to take retroactive action after more than two decades. However, at a minimum, we certainly need to make sure that something like this does not happen again. Please know that the Committee of Transportation and Infrastructure continues to monitor current business practices and labor negotiations at U.S. Airlines. There have been many lessons learned from Eastern's experience, and since then, several airlines have been created, merged, bought out, and shut down. The industry will continue to evolve, and so will management-labor relationships. Thank you again for taking time to share your concerns with me. Please do not hesitate to call on me again if I can ever be of assistance to you or your family." Signed, sincerely, John Micah, chairman of that committee. So he did finally respond to a request that we have been trying to get to someone in Congress, and so he's finally addressed that issue. Folks, we're getting very close to the end of our show, and it's about time we have, all the time we have for our tonight show. We hope you have enjoyed our trip down Eastern's memory lane, or Miami's memory lane, because Eastern was very much part of Miami history. We hope the new employees with the new Eastern Airlines will start fresh memories about the new Miami and their training days to tell their kids and grandkids and to share with future employees. The memory of Eastern Airlines will never fade away if we keep the love we have had over 85 years that we have still kept the memory alive. Jim, how about taking this broadcast to the archives as I hear the sign-off music in the background?
Certainly, Neil. Well, that's our show for tonight, folks. We'll be back with you next week, same time, same station. Tune in to www.ealradioshow.com. And like one of our popular commercials for Eastern, we have to earn our wings every day. Maybe in the not-too-distant future, we'll use a commercial with a suggestion like this. Hey, we're back home, and we hope we are in your home every Monday evening. Same time, same station at the EAL Radio Show. Next week, we hope you'll once again fly Eastern Radio as we bring you more Eastern news, history, and talk with former Eastern employees and friends of Eastern. Please be sure to tune in and call in at 7 p.m. That's Eastern Time, when Flight 78 departs the gate. Oh, and by the way, we have been on the air for 1 year and 6 months with episode number 78. Please be on board. Now, from all the gang here at our studios and remote locations, we say everyone, to all together, good night, Eastern
good night,
family.
Good night, Eastern family.
Eastern family. Family.
Good night to you, Luann, wherever you are.
Thank you, Jim.